Hey, we're going to get going, get started with our talk for tonight. As you can see, we're going to be talking, the title is The New Order, which is kind of what we're going to be talking about. But we're really going to be talking about two particular things. One, Christianity in the Far East, and then what is going on with Christianity in the early medieval period in Europe, particularly the sort of Central Europe as well. Let me get us going, open in prayer, and then we will just get underway. So, Father, that you have provided for us another time where we can get together, we're thankful for that. And, Father, we are mindful of these things that are on each of our hearts, the different prayer requests that are set before us as a church, the different people that are in need, those who are needing to be comforted. And, Father, we just continue as a group to lift them up. We would ask that you would be present in our place tonight. We thank you for each person that is here, the time that they are making, and that we get to see again how you have worked and your plan has worked itself out across many generations in the history of your church. We just commit this time to you in your precious name. Amen. Don't forget, we have handouts in the back if you want to tag along with us. I'm going to be using the PowerPoint behind me not to go through the actual the presentation you have. The document that you have is more important than the PowerPoint. I'm pretty much using the PowerPoint because I got some maps and some photographs of people from 800 or paintings. But they're probably more like paintings. Steve will give you that or Cracker Jacks or a Coke if you need that as well. But if anybody needs it, they'll be coming back in. But what we want to do tonight, we want to talk about some things that just sort of about the nature of Christianity. Too often we forget that Christianity, like other things, was a global religion from its beginnings. Because one of the things that happens, and we're sort of seeing this more and more, particularly if you're in schools of history, as I was going through different degrees with history and so forth, one of the things that we wanted to be mindful of is something called our horizons. And our horizons, you can imagine, it's that, literally that idea that we can only see so far. And one of the things that makes our horizons much shorter are the cultures that we're captive in, also our education. I was talking about my grandfather was a Baptist preacher in Oklahoma. Started a lot of churches with his bare hands, but he built them and so forth throughout Oklahoma. He never went to seminary. One of the things that, and he was a great, very good model for me. He passed away while I was in seminary, actually. But one of the things that I noticed from him is that there was always a limitation that he had because he never was able to get that seminary thing taken care of. And he acknowledged in his own ministry that would have been a great benefit for him. And I say that not to say that he was any lesser of a pastor. He's a wonderful pastor, had a great influence on a lot of people, but he knew that was a horizon in his life. A lot of times we're encumbered by horizons, and the story of Western history is that it's often taught from the Western perspective, and we forget about that Christianity was a global religion. Now, by 800, it wasn't global insofar as we understand global now, because they didn't really know that Texas existed, believe it or not. I know that that is a difficult thing to say, but it is true. But one of the things we want to remember is that Christianity is a global story, and that's one of the things we want to keep in front of us. And as we read its story from a Western perspective, we often read its story from a Western perspective but neglect the richness of other cultures. You can go through an entire history of Christianity and never realize that it went beyond Iraq, or it never went beyond the borders of Syria. Yet the reality is Christianity expanded into Africa, expanded into Asia, and into the Far East at a pace that is rather surprising for religions of its day. Because again, they didn't have highways, they didn't have cars. They would travel on foot. So tonight, what we want to do is we want to discuss two things. And we want to discuss the first thing that we want to be able to discuss, as this is going to be fun, the story of Christianity in the Far East. And by Far East, what do we mean by that? Asia? Particularly, what countries might we think about tonight? China? India? Yeah, Southeast Asian area. Japan? Korea? Absolutely. We're going to be talking about Christianity in the Far East. Now, we can talk about Christianity in the East, but in the context of the first 1,000 years, when we talk about the Eastern Church, we're talking about the church that was based in Byzantium or Constantinople. What we want to do is we want to expand our lens to talk about something that's much farther away from the seat of Christian, the seats of Christianity. And here's something that you're going to find out. There's a richness of that history that's often forgotten. And then we're also going to talk about the rise of Charlemagne and the Holy Roman Empire. We're going to spend most of our time, though, probably talking about Christianity in the Far East. So what we want to do is be able to do that. I have a little bit of a, one of the first images that I have is this, and you might be able to see it. I don't know how, I guess it's pretty clear. This is a woodcut from Heinrich Bunting that came out in 1581. And during this time, if you're familiar with art back in this day, it was a woodcut. They would literally cut into wood. And that was the way that they tried to get art. It was, and they would do artistic work that way. They didn't have access to a lot of metals or understood metals. This is a map that he created of the Christian world in 1581. Now, what do you immediately notice about this map? It has three parts to it, and it doesn't look like any map, any reasonable cartographer would say, navigate by this, because you're going to get lost. Now, it wasn't that they didn't have good maps back then. Actually, you can go to any number of resources and find maps older than this that are far more detailed. What Heinrich was trying to do is he was trying to make a point. Now, look at this map behind me. What are one thing that stands out to you? What give me a couple things that stand out to you. The what? The center. What's the center? It's Jerusalem. If you're a little closer, you can see that it's Jerusalem. Again, this isn't the best projector, but the best projection because of all the lighting and so forth. If we had a high-def TV that was from that side of the stage to that side of the stage, and it was up in NRG, we'd be able to see it very clearly. What we notice is we've got Jerusalem in the center, but you have three leaves to the map. And what are the three leaves to the map? Yeah, Europe, Asia, and Africa. Because Christianity was in Europe, Asia, and Africa. So this map is interesting because, one, it's a Trinitarian design. Now notice that it's a Trinitarian design because we have the three clovers or the three leaves. The other thing to notice is Jerusalem is at the center. And when you really think about it, if you pull back and think about a giant world map and you think about what they're talking about, again, they didn't have satellites back then. They didn't even know a lot. Now, in 1581, they knew a whole lot more than they did, 200 years prior. One of the things that you can see on the map, I don't know if my little pointer is going to work, but right over on this section, anybody who's close, can you read that, what that says? America. Because in 1492, Columbus sailed the Ocean Blue. Yeah. After a couple other people, discovered America-ish. He discovered the Canary Islands. So you see that. And actually, if we were able to expand it just a touch, there's up in here is Denmark and Sweden. But you see a lot of stuff with this. This map is there to represent sort of a theological interpretation of the church or a theological interpretation of the world. What's interesting in that in 1581, though Jerusalem was at the center, Jerusalem was nowhere close to the center of Christianity because of what was going on. But ultimately, what we see is that it's not accurate, but it's trying to make a theological point. So I put this up there because it's kind of a fun map to see as to what's going on. And with that, we want to get into our discussion because we recognize that Christianity is multifaceted. It has a lot going on with it. So let's talk about Christianity in the Far East. And we'll pick up with our page that you guys have in front of you. The church history reminds us that the apostles went in diverse directions and spread the gospel sometime following Pentecost. The reality is we see, and I've got a couple things that are listed here. There's a whole group of we can't call them scriptures, but there's a whole group of texts called the pseudepigraphal gospels or pseudepigraphal documents. These are documents that came out of Christianity that had some merit. And within these documents, though we did not accept them as part of the Bible, they do lend good historical data. One of the great problems of the book of Acts And we use problems as lightly as we can. Perhaps we could say challenges or strange things about it is there are really only two primary people in the book of Acts. Who are they? Peter and Paul. All the rest of the apostles disappear. We don't really know what happens to them. Now, there's a reason that Luke did this. I'm not going to get into that. Maybe if we do a historical study on Acts, we can talk a little bit about that. But you'll notice I've got a couple of these listed. Thomas, the doubter, though he did not carry that name with him. That's sort of a hard thing to write on the, hi, my name is Thomas the Doubter. It carries, it's like your transcript from elementary school. It follows you everywhere. Famously is believed to have traveled into India to start Christianity there. Andrew, it is said, went to Russia, or the land of the self-eaters, which makes it sound like the Russians were cannibals. This is, again, we're just pulling this out of the text, out of the, what it says about them. Simon the Zealot possibly went into the Persian Empire. Jude, perhaps, journeyed up to Britannia. There are a lot of different places that could, or Brittany, that could have, these guys could have gone. And one of the things that we do see is that there is a lot of movement that goes on. We're not really sure what happens to them, though. We're not sure what goes on with everything, with these apostles. It is likely that in Armenia and Georgia, we have the earliest adoptions of Christianity as the state religion in 301 and 327, respectively. Again, this is present-day Armenia and Georgia. There's something going on around Christianity that's not just Eurocentric. If we try to get a Eurocentric view of the church, we get a limited view of the church, and that's one of the reasons we want to be able to have this discussion tonight. About some of this. Christianity within several generations appears to have spread far into the East. And this is probably within several generations. It's across the world. Because the apostles were the first missionaries. And you really can take the idea of the office of apostle and you can make it out to be the first missionaries. That's really the function that they served. They didn't have this supreme authority that was invested in them by the papal see. They didn't know what any of that was. They weren't intending to have that. They were the first missionaries. They went into these diverse places and they went with the gospel to start churches to help reach those people who were away from Christ, who had no idea. And they went into these diverse cultures with that. Christianity, as we see, has gone into the Far East. This would have been the region present from Iran all the way to China. So you can imagine on a global map, this is a very large swath of sort of what's going on here. Probably what we aren't familiar with, unless you're a really good student of ancient history, is probably by the first century, China had as many people living in it as the region that we would call China has as many people living in it as does Europe. There are technological advances that are going on that far outstrip what's happening in Europe at this time as well, and that we'll see. Christianity found itself among a highly pluralistic culture where Hindu and Buddhism were among the chief religions. And also Christianity flourished until about 1300 among Buddhist Zoroastrians, Manichaeans, though it would be a different kind of Christianity than was practiced in the Western church from this period. One of the things that we're going to touch on here in a few moments is that there is a diversity that happens. There is a whole group of people that get cast out of the Western church, and they don't stop believing. They just go to the East to help to move their version of Christianity along, and what ultimately flourishes is their brand of Christianity, so forth. Again, and then a larger point, the primary group of Christianity that grew in the Far East were Nestorians. This is, as I was just mentioning, and where do we remember Nestorians from? They're in our list of heretics. Yeah, they had a guy that was Nestorius, who was a bishop, and they had a very specific view of Jesus that a council got together for and said, that's not the view we're adopting. So they were still around. They just went into the East. Demographically, by about 1,000 or 81,000, this is what Christianity might have looked like. In Asia, we had 18.5 million people, or I'm sorry, 18.5 million Christians. In Africa, we had 5 million Christians. And in Europe, we had 40 million Christians. Now, I also teased this out because we're going to address this. By 1450, what do we have? 3.4 million Christians in Asia. We have 750,000 Christians in Africa, and we have 75 million Christians in Europe. Just real quick, what happens to Asia and Africa? They decline pretty substantially. We're going to touch on why that happens. We see that there are a couple things that go on. Some of the key features of the Far East, one of the things that we're going to pick up on is as Christianity spread into the Far East, it did it differently than it went about it in Europe. It didn't go and affiliate itself with a civic organization, a civic government, or a civil become a civil religion. What's so unique about the time where they are in the Far East, again, this is from Iraq to China, this is a highly pluralistic society with a lot of different belief groups. And Christianity goes in, and it doesn't try to become the dominant power. It honestly looks like the church would have looked like if Constantine never existed or had never converted. It looks very different. And among that, Christianity becomes very adapted to the culture. Christianity becomes very adapted to the culture, and it's one of the things that we're going to touch on. This is a book that I picked up. It's a really good one. It's by a guy named Philip Jenkins, and he's currently a researcher at Penn State University. He's written some amazing books about current demographic trends in Christianity, and he has some things where he's talked about where the center of Christianity is. This is a really interesting book. It's a very good, very readable book called The Lost History of Christianity. And you can notice, this is just sort of the way that I do notes, but there's a lot of good stuff in here. And on page 63, let me read something for you here real quick. I'm sorry, that's page 66. On page 63, we see that this is something that was begin talking. Now, there was a guy who was a metropolitan leader. Now, a metropolitan leader is someone who is a bishop of a large city over top of many other bishops. What might we call him today? An archbishop or a cardinal? So they were over top of a lot of bishops. Notice what this says. This is, he's talking about how they began moving into this new area in the Far East, and they encountered a king who was on his way to battle. And it was always, you know, sort of like the big thing for evangelicals today is if a sports player becomes a Christian, or if Bill Gates becomes a Christian. There's like this thing about celebrity in our culture, because celebrities are kind of the kings and queens of our culture. Back then, the kings and queens were the celebrities of the culture. And the whole goal was, we need to convert that king, because if you converted that king, what did that mean for Christianity or your religion? Yeah, you're going to get some publicity. You're going to possibly get some money. That's always a good thing. You're going to be in the favor of the king. You're going to have the military backing you. Again, it's not that much, though there are some significant differences, it's not that much different from a lot of things today. Notice what it says here. The metropolitan approaches this king and is talking about it. And then this king was moved, or the metropolitan, this bishop, was moved by divine power, and he made the sign of the heavenly cross and rebuked the unreal thing and that the rebellious demons had set up, and forthwith disappeared completely. And when the king saw that Saint Elijah or Saint Elias had been able to do this, he was converted with all of his army. And the saint took them to the stream and baptized them all. Must have been a big stream, and ordained them for priests and deacons and returned to his country. And then they went into battle as priests and deacons, and guess what happened? They won, and that was good because the king became a Christian, because the king saw a miracle. But here's the problem that would pop up. The next time the famine came up, the priest reached out to the metropolitan to do another miracle. Because again, this is a mystical society. This is a magician kind of society. Guess what that bishop wasn't able to do? Another miracle. So Christianity kind of fell on hard times. This is the story of what happens with Christianity in the East. It's a little snapshot. This is a wonderful resource, by the way, if you're interested in a good resource on Christianity in the East. So let's move along. We've got some stuff to cover. One of the most, I think I've moved some of my notes around. Tell me on the page 2, what's the first couple words of the first bullet? Okay. I moved some of my notes around, and I have my old notes. You shouldn't take notes on your old notes. I do this all the time, though. But established in 425 in Merv, or Alexandria, Merginia. This is what is modern-day Turkmenistan. Basically, it became one of the great centers of Christianity that happened. This was in about 500. There was a Christian academy in Merv that was translating essential works, including biblical texts into the languages of the Far East. It was, again, a Nestorian community. We probably believe that at this point, there were a lot of things going on in the Far East. Some Christian organizations, by maybe 500, 600, or 800, had their own translations of the Bible in their own language. That's a huge accomplishment, because how long did it take to get the Bible into the modern language in Europe? It took till the 1500s and a guy named Martin Luther. And then it took even longer to 1611 to get the authorized version in English. So we see some of this stuff is going on there. And I think this should be your guys' next point. One of the most significant figures in the Far East, is that your guys' next point? Okay, good. One of the most significant figures is Timothy the Patriarch, who was elected to lead the Far Eastern Church in about 780. Under his leadership, they would expand. Notice this, by the end of his tenure as the Patriarch of the Far East, he wasn't called the Patriarch of the Far East, he was called a little something different, but he was essentially the Pope over the Far Eastern churches. He had 19 metropolitans, or 19 archbishops underneath him, with 85 bishops. At this same period of time in England, or Britannia, or Brittany, there were two archbishops in York and Canterbury, and only a handful of bishops. During this time, he lived in a pluralistic age. There's actually a really interesting story there, that first subpoint, about an Indian Buddhist who came to the Chinese capital. This Indian Buddhist came with a bunch of Sanskrit sutras. Now, if you are in Hinduism or Buddhism, this sutra is the way that they would do scripture. And he came with all these scriptures, and they were in a language he didn't understand. So he comes to the Chinese capital, and he begins going around to all these different religions trying to see if somebody will help him. Well, the archbishop in China at the time is a guy named Adam. He finds this guy, and he goes, "Adam, can you help me with my translation?" And Adam had just finished translating parts of the New Testament into Chinese in 782. Adam sits down and goes, "You know what? We all get along out here. Let's go ahead. I'm going to help you." So Adam sits down and helps him translate. These two texts become the foundation of Buddhism in Japan for the next 1,000 years. This is the nature of Christianity. To give you a little bit, and I've got the last point there, that at the same time in Europe, Charlemagne was beheading 4,500 Saxons for not converting to Catholicism. So you see a bit of a difference between Far Eastern Christianity and what's going on in Europe. Far Eastern Christianity is very much ingrained in the culture. There's a lot that's going on there. Let me give you a couple slides here. I'm going to try to get to, if I can get to it here. I got some stuff. Nestorians were the primary leaders. This is a map of essentially the major metropolitan bishoprics, which are the major centers of Christianity across Asia. I think you can sort of get the gist. There's not a lot of contrast here. But from over on, sort of on this side of the map, that's so you see Jerusalem is right there. Right in the center here is Tibet. Down here is southwest India, where there's a big pocket of Christians. And then over here is the eastern, sort of the eastern shore of China on this side of the map. There were a large distribution of Christians. Sort of give you a little bit better shot. This is sort of towards the end of Christianity in the Far East. This is the swath. This is the impacted region that Christianity had, essentially from in the Eastern Church, but particularly from Iraq all the way up into Mongolia and into China. This is a significant influence. And if you didn't read all of history, you would miss that in this time, close to 50 million Christians lived and had parts of faithfulness in their lives. This is the way that the church expanded. This is sort of a good map of what's going on. So the first, you'll notice a couple things I've got in here. I want to keep moving along with this. Another point. The first formal mission to China began in 635 at the end of the Tang Dynasty. What was interesting about this is when that first formal mission happened, the Tang Dynasty was coming to an end because it was being invaded by other countries and other nations. So there was space to be charitable. What was interesting also is that when this first Christian mission happened, they discovered Christian monks that were already living in China that were involved in the silk trade. When Marco Polo would go through in the 1200s and he would go into China, he found Christians in China. Not huge amounts of them, but he found Christians. In India, Thomas's legacy has a lasting impact on the churches there. We see a lot that's going on in that area. I've also got a little quote there from 550 Cosmos. This is at the top of, I believe, page 3 for you guys. Cosmos, an Indian sailor, reports, and so likewise among the Bactrians and the Huns and the Persians and the rest of Indians and Parmesians, or Persharmenians, excuse me, and the Medes and the Elamites, and throughout the whole land of Persia, there is no limit on the number of churches with bishops and very large communities of church Christian people, as well as many martyrs and monks living as hermits. In 1500, in one sector of India, probably we believe it was down in that southeast sector, right around where that big cross is at the center of the map, down in that southeast section, we know that there are 30,000 faithful Christian families living in India. The Christian church had expanded into the Far East and was doing well. And you'll see there, Christianity in the Far East flourished. Though much of it in historical obscurity from about 500 till about 1400. One of the challenges that we get into in this period is that Christianity did really well. And when Christianity does really well, it has a tendency not to keep track of itself. We don't have a lot of documents to begin with from this period, but there are a lot of things that are going on. Let me show you a picture that I have. This is the oldest church in China. And this church is, let me find my note on this. This church is basically from about, I think I have it in here. This church is from about 550, and oh, I'm sorry, it's in 640 in Dakin. And this is it started off of a monastery, but it's an Nestorian church. It fell into disrepair. But you can go into China today and you can find this church standing, and it was built in 640. So you have parts of Christianity in China from as early as 640. You can see I put on the right hand side, you can see some of the images from within that church. These are depictions of saints, of the Christian story. If you get farther into it, there are some things that go on. There used to be a library there as well. There are some amazing things that happen with Christianity in the Far East at this time. Then picking up sort of towards the end of our notes for Christianity in the Far East. Christianity flourished in this time period. And Christianity, and we still see that it exists, but, and notice this, we could reasonably say that there were three centers of Christianity by about 1000 AD, one of which is Rome, the second of which is Constantinople. Now, as we're going to talk about in some subsequent weeks, you guys have probably already mentioned, we've already probably mentioned it here in the last couple weeks where I wasn't here. What happens in 1040 between Rome and Constantinople? They split. It's called the Great Schism. And they split over basically an eye in one word, but it's a little bit deeper than that. But ultimately, you could say there are three by 1,000. There are three centers of Christianity, Rome, Constantinople, and China. This is where the bulk of Christians lived. There's a guy, Yabala III was a Syriac bishop who lived from 1281 to 1370, or not lived, he presided as a bishop from 1281 to 1317. And it is thought that in this time period, he had the greatest power and influence of any Christian leader in the world. He was currently over 30 provinces with 60 archbishops and 250 bishops. Rome pales in comparison to his influence. That's going on at the time. Christians lived in peace with their neighbors. One of the things that's interesting is that we see that there are some things that begin happening, though, and in the confluence of history, there are some things that go on. Christianity lived at peace with their neighbors, the Zoroastrians and the Manichaeans and the Taoists and the Buddhists and the Hindus. And even the Muslim governments they live in peace with, but there begins a change. And by about 1400 from that first page, you see the numbers begin falling away significantly. There are a number of things that contribute to this, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but notice this, and I've got several points here. What led to Christianity's faltering in the Far East? Well, one of the first things is hostile regimes of Islam, Buddhism, and ultimately xenophobic royal dynasties. There's probably no more xenophobic royal dynasty than the Ming Dynasty in the 12th century. Christianity actually did really well with the Mongolian Empire. And who was the great leader of the Mongols from ancient times? It was Genghis, not the one from Star Trek, but Genghis Khan, and you had Kublai Khan that came after him. What's interesting is I had been taught by tradition that Christianity encountered Genghis Khan, and Genghis Khan wiped out Christianity. It's not the case. As we do research into this, as we learn the story, we find that Christianity actually had a lot of acceptability with the Mongols. And as the Mongols came into China and took over that whole region, they began a large attack over the whole of the Far East. And they got as far as to Syria at one point before being beaten back. But when they expanded too much, it allowed the Ming Dynasty to rise up in China. And the Ming Dynasty wanted to do away with all foreigners. They wanted to do away with all foreign cults. And in order to do that, Christianity was one of them. They began pulling Christians and persecuting them and killing them and murdering them. But then the other thing that happens is Islam becomes increasingly radicalized. Now, if you and I had seen Islam from up until about the year, about 900, Islam and Christianity would have been very similar. But as we talked about 3 weeks ago, the primary way that Muhammad himself advanced his influence was by the what? By the sword, yeah. In Islam, what happens is they begin pushing into these regions. They begin pushing across the globe. And what happens is they then all of a sudden begin finding their power and finding the foothold. And Islam becomes the greatest persecutor of Christianity in the Far East beyond anything that xenophobic empires could have done, slaughtering millions of Christians. And it's very dangerous. Notice a couple other things real quick, and we're going to move on to Charlemagne. A lack of deep cultural roots in the communities they were serving was a contribution. They were bringing in a lot of people from around Turkey, even into Israel. What's today present-day Israel was then Palestine and Egypt. They were bringing in a lot of these monks and missionaries to do the work. They weren't trying to find close cultural people to help lead the church. It was always foreigners coming in to lead the church. And that can go well for a while, but they didn't create deep roots. Additionally, differences in immigration and birth rates between Christians and other cultures. And by immigration, really the biggest immigrant force was Muslims coming into the Far East and bringing with them this Quranic tradition. But then, as is currently happening in our world today, the Muslim birth rate far exceeded Christian birth rate by 2 to 3 kids per family within a generation. And as we're able to track even today, when you start having more babies than people that are outside of your culture, eventually what's going to happen to the other culture? It's going to go away, or it's going to become absorbed by your culture because yours is going to become the dominant culture. Also, there were some language issues. Christianity carried no official language but adapted to the culture. Wherever Christianity goes, it adapts to the culture. Islam, though, brings its own language, and what's the language of Islam? It's Arabic. Yeah, they bring their own holy text, which is in Arabic. And with Christianity, though, it was this blend, and that ultimately leads to the last point on this, the faltering. Christianity became too enculturated in these regions, and it lost its distinctiveness. There is, and let me read this to you. I found, if you have the Dariad McCullough text that we recommended, this is in there, and I don't have an exact page number, but listen to this. This is from a Alpian, who was specialized working with Buddhists in about 800, wrote this, and he wrote a story. He wrote the history of Jesus' life using what he knew from church tradition, but also from the Gospels and different fragments. And he writes this about Jesus: all the Buddhas, as well as all the Kinaras and the superintending Devas and the Arans, can see the Lord of Heaven. No human being, however, has seen the Lord of Heaven. All the Buddhas flow in flux by virtue of this very wind, while in this world there is no place where the wind does not reach. Now, is that the way that we're going to describe Jesus? No. But they chose to use the current language and customs of their time. This is a very Buddhist way of describing Jesus. And what ultimately happens in our last point about this and the faltering was Christianity became so absorbed in its culture that it's lost its distinctiveness. Jesus became so much like Buddha, there was no reason to believe that he was anything but another Buddha that had come into this world. Jesus didn't stay Lord of this world, he became another opportunity for belief. One of the challenges of Christianity is sometimes we can become so dissolved in our own world that we lose our distinctiveness. And that's what ultimately, one of the things that would happen. That's really about the Far East. And we wanted to touch on it because I really believe that a Christianity or history of Christianity that neglects the story about the Far East is one that neglects really the whole of Christianity. And that's an important thing. And those things that go on with Christianity in the Far East are things that still impact us today because they're very important. But I would like to, after talking about the Far East, I want to move now to talk about Charlemagne. Charles the Great. This is Charles the Great, a painting of him. Excuse me. And it's from Getty Images, in case you can't tell. But this is one of my favorite pictures of Charlemagne because it really depicts what people thought of him or what he thought of himself. And what do you get, what do you see about Charlemagne here? We see a couple things. One, we notice that he's an emperor because he's got a crown on his head. What's he carrying in his right hand? The church, absolutely. That's St. Peter's Basilica. He's carrying St. Peter's Basilica in his hand, but he also has the imperial scepter in his left hand. And notice, and again, whenever somebody paints something, when a painter of this era, like sometimes we get ready to take a picture, you're like, somebody's taking a selfie or somebody's taking a picture of something, you're not thinking about all the stuff that's going on behind them. These painters, they were like Bob Ross. Remember Bob Ross? Like, it was always a happy place or a happy mistake. These guys were very intentional about what they were doing. Notice that he's also got a sword. So he's not just an emperor that comes in peace with the church. He's also an emperor that has military behind him. This is a really, and he's also clothed in armament. He has the knight's regalia on underneath his imperial robes. This is Charlemagne. This is Charles the Great. And we learn a lot about him. He's a very significant individual in the history of Christianity. We see his life dates are April 2nd, 742 to January 28th, 814. He was 71 years old when he died. He was, his titles were Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and before that, the King of the Franks, or the Franks. He was a Carolingian king. I don't want to get into a deep discussion. There were some dynasties of their own, if you will. If you think about, we just finished talking about China, and we always remember a lot of things about the Far East in terms of dynasty, the Ming Dynasty, the Tang Dynasty. But in Europe, they had their own dynasties. They just didn't call them dynasties. They were different sects or different family lines, the Lombards, the Merovingians, the Carthaginians, the Carolingians. These are all families that would rule over areas and throughout some generations. He was a Carolingian king who conquered and expanded his empire. Charlemagne in Western Europe becomes the major transition point. And several weeks ago, we talked about great people in history. All of history in Western Europe comes to Charlemagne at some point because he is that significant. So who was he? What did he have going on? Notice a couple of significant life events. He had some significant life dates, some coronations. He was coronated the king of the Franks in 768. And then after he defeated the Lombards, he was crowned their king in 774. Interesting story about him taking over the Lombards. In this day and age, if you conquered a king, we were far more civil than we were at some points. We didn't cut the king's head off or the queen's head off. We didn't kill their children. We just made them monks. And what happened is, and this is the way the story goes, he goes into Lombard, which is basically in Italy, in the kingdom of Lombardy. He goes into, which is basically in northern Italy, and he goes in and they take over the military, and because they don't have cell phones and nobody can post it on Facebook, no one knows that they've defeated the army, yet his contingent goes into the capital and they go to the king's bedside and they wake him up. In the morning, mid-morning, like before you're supposed to be awake, you know, they've obviously come in, they've taken everything over, they wake him up, they wake his sons up, and they strip them down, they put the monk's clothes on them, they cut their hair off at the top of their head, and they send them to a monastery for the rest of their life. So, instead of cutting off his head, they cut off his hair, and then they took his crown. So this is how they did things with Charlemagne. So he became king of the Lombards in 774. He ultimately becomes the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, though they didn't call it that until the 1300s. He did that by Pope Leo III on December 25th. And what happens on December 25th every year? Christmas. He was in St. Peter's Basilica on Christmas Day, 800. And he goes for his coronation, and one thing happens that never has happened since, because they learned their lesson. Pope Leo III crowns him with this crown, and it's probably, I'll show you, this probably, we'll get to it, it's probably this crown. I'll get to what this is here in a minute. This one on my left, your guy's right, you can see a little bit of the crown. It had the large thing. It was actually several crowns put together because it demonstrated who he had conquered. But what happens is Leo III crowns him king of the Holy Roman Empire, and he kneels before Charlemagne. This was significant because the church would kneel before Charlemagne for the rest of his life. And they would never repeat... Excuse me, they would never repeat that error. A couple other significant life dates. He obviously defeated the Lombards in 774. And then in 792, he became the sole ruler of the Carolingian Empire after his co-emperor had passed away. This map that's on the left that we have up here sort of shows you what he was able to accomplish. Now, we're all familiar with the map of Europe as it exists today. Anything in purple is what Charlemagne conquered. And anything in light blue, that's what Charlemagne conquered as well. He began his sort of his kingliness in this region right here, and he expanded all the way over into what is now modern day sort of Eastern Germany. This was a big deal. These were people that didn't want to be conquered. So we see that his major influences, even though a Christian, he readily used military force against other Christian rulers to expand his empire. He initiated a campaign in his territory once he became emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. He initiated a campaign to build large, expansive church buildings and aid Rome in its growth. One of the things that went with him being... being crowned by Pope Leo, is that he sought to unite the church and the state. And this right here in 800 signals a massive shift that still impacts us today. Because at this point, the Roman Catholic Church becomes fused with the Holy Roman state. And that between the two of them, they move forward in a significant way together. And as we'll see here in a few moments, how the Holy Roman Empire operates still impacts a little bit of what goes on in Europe today and so forth. He provided resources for a large-scale system of manuscript copying and production. Again, this is 800. So how are you creating manuscripts at this time? Yeah, by hand. Have you ever tried to do that? One of the devotional practices that I adopted while I was in college, I do it occasionally today, but I was doing it a lot when I was in college, and this guy had come through, I forget who it was, but he wrote a book about doing devotionals, and he said, one of the things, if you really want to get some in-depth study of Scripture, sit down, go and buy some paper, some of that lined paper, whether that's wide margin, college ruled, whatever, and put your Bible next to it and write down word for word from a chapter or two. And try it out and see what happens. Go home and try it sometime and see how hard it is, because it's really hard for us, because you have to be very intentional, because you're writing in ink. And imagine this time, God hadn't created the person who created the eraser or the pencil. So if you messed up on a manuscript on the last letter of a page that you'd spent all day copying, what'd you get to do tomorrow? Redo it, because you didn't have lights to keep you awake at night. So, I mean, what ultimately that Charlemagne created, he created an actual new system of script. He created a new font, if you will, for his imperial majesty. And he created a system where you could create more manuscripts at a faster rate. This was helpful. He tied the power of his empire to the papacy, expanding the influence of both beyond anything before him. He reformed monastic life and the liturgy of the Catholic Church. He created a couple different things that would go on even today with that. Also, and this is the real critical thing, when you look across the scope of Europe, this is, if you take away anything from Charlemagne's life and rule, this is the critical thing that he did. He removed the last vestiges of barbarism from Europe. And notice what he did. He renewed Roman law and civic law. Barbarian laws were what kind of law? Give me an example of maybe a barbarian law. You go and find out that someone killed your horse, so you go and kill that person's horse. You know, it was sort of this blood for blood, eye for an eye kind of a law. It's very arbitrary. What the Roman law had is it was a system of due process. So that immediately begins creating some sort of civic outline of how things should operate. Also, he created early city building activity with architectural innovations. This is going back to Rome, the gleaming city of Rome, and bringing it into Europe, that at this current stage, so much of your cities are still mud huts and clay huts. They begin using things like stone and brick. I know, it's brilliant, isn't it? To build your houses and those things. So that's a huge, they stop using straw as your foundation and your walls. But then the other thing is he began formal education systems, particularly through Alcuin's influence, including early academies and libraries. Libraries had disappeared for about 500 years. And what Charlemagne brings is he brings these whole systems of reform. And the barbarian hordes that had plagued Europe for 1,000 and 2,000 years begin going away, because education is the silver bullet for so much of what we have in life. And by bringing education, bringing civil reforms, and bringing the city-state, or bringing, sort of rebuilding cities, Charlemagne begins an effort to reform Europe and to bring it back into the intellectual center where it needed to be. Also, he removed the gold standard as the basis for his economic system in favor of silver. The thing that it would do is your silver was worth as much as you weighed. So if you had just as much silver as you weighed, that was essentially one for one, and then you would go outside of that. He moved it off of gold because gold was hard to find. But in Europe, silver at the time was very easy to find. So he created a system of coinage based on currency that everybody had access to. Because only the super elite had access to gold, silver is something that almost everybody had access to. So when everybody's able to start having money coming through their house, it makes things better. And that's one of the things that he did. And ultimately, he united Europe under a church-state office that would dramatically expand the influence and power of both. Though by 843, his territories would be divided among his family under the Treaty of Verdun. And that didn't last very long. But this is Charlemagne. And I don't want to give him a short shrift, but we sort of have to. He was extraordinarily influential with Europe. And real, yes, in the back. Alcuin was a tutor. He was a scholastic. Now, I don't want to say that Charlemagne began scholasticism. That's a different conversation for a couple weeks from now. There was always an intellectual thing going on in Europe. There's always academics somewhere. It's just they were repressed for a very long time. Now, we don't need to call it the Dark Ages, but we weren't completely there. But Alcuin was someone who ultimately became the court tutor for Charlemagne's court, his royal court. And he basically came in and he tutored. He was the central figure. He probably had a bunch of people working for him that were all smart too. But he's the central figure. He had the university, or the academy system, we should say. He had the academy system sort of back in his head that he had heard about. Because academies had existed in the Far East for a long time. The Far East at this point in about 800 to 814 was far beyond Europe in terms of technological advancement and medical advancement. We just forget all that. But yeah, that's a good question about Alcuin. Let me hit the Holy Roman Empire real quick. The critical thing that you need to know about the Holy Roman Empire is that it was not holy, it was not Roman, and it was not an empire. That's the only, if you take anything away from all this, just know that the Holy Roman Empire was not holy, it was not Roman, and it was not an empire. That's the critical thing. They were Europeans, so they wanted to do whatever they want to with that. So if you can take anything away from that. It lasted from 800 to 1806. How much difference is 800 to 1806? I know this is quick math, but how much difference? 1,000 years. What was Hitler trying to do in World War II? He wanted to reestablish the 1,000-year reign of his new empire. Because now, let's be honest, it really wasn't an empire. I'll show you a map here in a second. You'll see how crazy it is for them to say that that was the case. Its date's 800, or technically 962. Historians will say 800 because what happened at 800? Charlemagne was crowned by Leo III. Actually, it was really Otto the First in 962, but it's not as convenient to say it started 162 years later because you don't get the millennium thing. There's a way to work around that. That's why I have it in parentheses, but it goes all 1806. So basically, it's a political system in Central Europe comprised of independent states, kingdoms, and provinces united under the leadership of the Catholic Church. Basically, it's Germany, Switzerland, and some of those outlying Bavarian regions. It's excuse me. You can see the significance there. A couple significant dates there. Charlemagne crowned emperor in 800. Treaty of Verdun. Basically, the Treaty of Verdun takes what is the Holy Roman Empire at the time and divides it between Charlemagne's three legitimate sons. He had 19 illegitimate sons that couldn't go to, but he went to three legitimate sons. By 950, it functionally stopped existing and went away for about 12 years until Otto I is crowned emperor. 1618 through 1648, that's not what we're going to talk about in this semester, but that was the start of the 30 Years' War. You will never find a conflict that was more bloody and more destructive than the 30 Years' War, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. Ultimately, it was formally dissolved by Emperor Francis II after his defeat by Napoleon in the Battle of Austerlitz. It's supposedly existed for 1,000 years. But here's the challenge. The Holy Roman Empire, again, was neither holy, was neither Roman, it was not an empire. It was a bunch of independent states. It was a bunch of independent kingdoms and provinces. It's important because of the following things. Let me hit on these. The duration of its existence, its impact politically and religiously. Because this was the center of Europe, it became a massive power for the church to use, to wield. And guess what else came out of the Holy Roman Empire? The Crusades. And we're going to talk about those in a couple weeks. But also the systems that it created. It creates a system, and you'll see that here in the notes, of imperial estates, courts, kingdoms, provinces, that ultimately create the conditions necessary for serfdom to exist. Serfdom is the means by which Europe existed for about 500 to 600 years, whereby the average person served a lord, the lord served a king, and it was the distribution of power that happened. It was horrible times. So we're not going to talk about that with that. But it's also the ecclesiastical power was centralized there. excuse me. Here's a map of the Holy Roman Empire. Everything in the center of the screen that is yellow is the Holy Roman Empire. So we basically see, what countries do you see in there? Well, we see Bohemia, Saxony, Burgundy, Italy, Moravia, which is modern-day Belgium, which is modern-day Netherlands, which is modern-day Germany, which is modern-day Austria, which is modern-day Switzerland. Don't mess with the Swiss. This is modern-day Northern Italy. That's what it looked like. But here's a different map for you. This is in 1000. This is in 1400. This is what the Holy Roman Empire looked like in kingdoms. Now, what do you notice about that? There's a lot of colors on that map. Every one of them was almost every one of them was independent of each other. As we get into the Reformation, we're going to see that Martin Luther, as he went to Wittenberg, nailing his theses on the castle church door of Wittenberg, or the door of the castle church in Wittenberg, he has an elector of Saxony that becomes his sort of his protector. The king of Saxony becomes his protector. But there's a whole system in place of feudal power on top of ecclesiastical power that he has to deal with. The Holy Roman Empire, again, it was neither holy nor Roman, nor was it an empire, was this conglomeration of independent states that all functioned alongside the auspices of the Catholic Church. It became the economic center power for the Catholic Church. When they needed to build St. Peter's Basilica or rebuild St. Peter's Basilica, where did they send Tetzel? Right here. Why? Because that's where all the money was. And that's where Tetzel was going through a coin in the coffer springs of soul from purgatory springs. That you were able to buy your aunt and uncle and your mom and dad out of purgatory, according to their system. They went there because that was the economic powerhouse of Europe. Germany is still technically the economic powerhouse of Europe. It's going away right now. But that's where they were able to go. The Holy Roman Empire worked in this way. It created a seamless system between the church and the state. And it created the conditions by which Christianity would grow in Europe faster and with more power than it did in the Far East. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that next week.